Chief Tony Clues, we mostly know him. He's got a new project that's just gone through Kickstarter and gotten well funded. He's going to give away books of pictures of official Ottawa.
There you go. That's all we need. I guess the precursor for this is I spent 5 years hanging around with drug addicts and prostitutes and doing that whole thing, and it was really fantastic and exciting, and I don't know, I thought it was kind of important, but it also sort of wrecked me in a way. It really affected my psyche, and it took me about a year to recover from that. And I thought, well, okay, what am I going to do? I'm a photographer, and photographers take pictures, so maybe I should, you know, take pictures. And being the contrary kind of person I am, I thought, well, what's the opposite of what I've just done? I often think about that. When I was down on the corner photographing drug addicts, The first pictures I took were at night of these real sort of set up tableaus, very painterly. And then I thought I wanted to go back because I was really fascinated by that society down there. And I wanted to do some more work. And I thought, well, okay, but I don't want to do that again. So what's the opposite of that? So I did large format portraits of women's heads. So that's a lot how I work is whatever I do this time, I kind of want to look for the other side of the coin the next time. So I thought, well, if I just spend a lot of time photographing people who essentially don't have much power, why don't I look at how the power is manifested in this city? So what I did is, I started sort of with Ottawa in general, but then I really quickly zeroed in, okay, how does the federal presence manifest itself here? I think this is something that we walk by all the time and we never really pay that much attention to because of our proximity to it. And I think that that even though we don't notice things, all the stuff we don't notice still affects us somehow. It goes into our brains, or it affects the juju of a city as a whole, and stuff like that. So I started photographing all the obvious things. I photographed the Prime Minister's Bulletproof Limousine, and I started photographing like places like Department of National Defense and stuff like that. All the obvious things. I was shooting from a list, which was kind of, you know, there was definitely a drama deficit in my life by shooting from a list, because all my work before was, you know, go there, meet these people, get in the car, go to a crack house and hang out. So that was, you know, who knew what was going to happen. This was me sort of lugging my 4x5 out and going, okay, I'm going to photograph Department of National Defense. But as I carried on doing this, what I realized is that my the list expanded, and I started using or realizing that there was a more diverse way to show, not to show, but the list didn't have to be always obvious things, although I really liked the obvious things. And the other beauty of doing that is, unlike all my previous work, most of the time I went out, like if I was one to photograph a Tiny's Pasture, for instance, I went about 4 or 5 or 6 times to Tiny's Pasture trying to figure out how to photograph that place. It was always there, so I could always go back and try again after, you know, 5 failures. How do you show Tiny's Pasture? The other thing I was doing is everything was shot on overcast days, because I didn't want there to be any drama in these pictures. So that's also the opposite of what I'd just done, which was like super dramatic images of drug addicts. So what I wanted to do was subtract all the drama. I didn't want the pictures to be about the way the light was striking buildings or glowing windows or streaking car lights or anything like that. I just wanted to really plainly show how the federal presence was manifested here. And I wanted to show it in a way that wasn't really necessarily screaming at people. I didn't want it to be didactic. But I wanted it to be kind of pointed in a quiet way. And a lot of the pictures, I think there's a kind of a quiet symbolism that I've used. This is the last picture in the book. It's actually on the back cover. This is a CNN truck on Elgin Street the day after the attacks on Parliament Hill, which I think is kind of interesting because, you know, official Ottawa just sort of grinds along, and it's only if someone gets shot that people actually outside pay attention to it. So if I can go forward or backwards here. Let's try going backwards. I'll go this way. Stop. I don't know what
no,
I'm
just
doing.
Just say okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then
you can't actually say it. You got to say it to the thing,
yeah?
How do you say okay to this?
Arrow back to okay.
Arrow back to okay. And then the middle one?
Center mount.
And now push a button.
Push an arrow the other way.
What if I press an up arrow? Can you pass that to the man who knows what's going on? Good work.
Good.
Okay,
good.
You're in charge.
Right,
you're in charge. I'll go like this. What? The right one?
Right hand
arrow.
Right
hand. Okay.
Just leave it with
normal.
Press.
Okay.
Press.
Thank you. Okay. So this is the building that houses the Conservative Party of Canada headquarters. And I had tried for maybe a year and a half to get in to shoot an interior of the place. Phone calls, emails, trying different people. And then they first of all said no, and then they just didn't answer my messages. So I thought, okay, that sucks, because I would really like to show that, since that seems to be kind of central. Then one day, that's at, I think, 150 Slater, there on the 12th floor. I was walking by the building and I looked up and I thought, I'm glad they didn't let me in, because this is even more perfect, just the sort of the Stalinist, brutalist architecture of the building, to me, speaks volumes about what it is, and showing the inside, I think, might have been not as interesting, because it would have just looked like an office. So that's also me being really slow on the uptake. You know, I spent a year and a half walking by that building. I knew where it was, and I never actually stopped to look up. This is all shot with 4-5, and there's 6 or 7 of the images where I'm not using the rise or the any of that. I just go to the place, tilt the camera up, and take the picture. I wanted these all to be really, really simple. This is the CSIS headquarters. And I tried to photograph that about 4 different times, and sort of at various locations, and it's I think the front is on Blair Road or something, and that's the obvious place. And then I thought, okay, well, I'm going to go behind it, and that's actually an access road to the National Research Council. And I just sort of like the juxtaposition of the pastoral beauty and the sinister quality of what goes on in that building. And this is the 3rd floor of Center Block, facing towards the west. I had photographed on Parliament Hill. There's a public washroom that, if you go up Parliament Hill and then go to the west, under a statue, there's a public washroom for the tourists and people. So I went in and I photographed that, and I thought, wow, I'd really like to. I should have brought it, but I didn't. I'd really like to photograph a private bathroom. So I phoned a guy I know who is an assistant to a Liberal member of Parliament, and I said, yo, Matt, can you get me in? And he said, yeah. So he got me in, and I'm shooting with a 4-5, right? Sneaking pictures. So I went on a tour of looking for private washrooms in Center Block. So I would like go into a washroom, and it was like too small, or I go in another one and I didn't like the look of it. And then finally we found one, and again, I wish I'd brought it, but it was like marble and mahogany, beautiful thing. The door to the stall was open, and it was just like the cheapest commode you've ever seen in your life, and the seat was up, which I thought was kind of perfect. So I'm in there, like setting up the shot with my Linhof, got the thing over, and this was it was during the summer, so the house wasn't sitting. And at a certain point, a security guy comes in, and I go, oh, man, it's like, what's he going to say? So I sort of pretend to wash my hands, and this guy, you ever seen Austin Powers, the movie, when he wakes up from being asleep for like 200 years or whatever it is, and then he has to take a leak, and it goes on? And, well, this guy had to take a leak, and it was like he'd been frozen for a decade. It went on. I must have washed my hands about 15 times. I sort of sorted through my film magazines and stuff like that. Finally, he left, and I'm sort of jammed up against the wall because I only ever use one lens. All the work I do, I work with standard lenses. Well, this is a 150 on a 4-5. Is that standard? I don't know. It's like maybe slightly wide, but anyway. So anyway, while we were walking around, after I did the tour of the private washrooms, I thought, well, if I'm here, I might as well shoot some pictures of the interior as well. This is the Department of National Defense, which is usually seen from the canal. And like a lot of my work, I think not only physically, but maybe psychologically or symbolically, I like to move around to the side of things to show them. There's like, okay, here's where everyone stands. This is what everyone knows. What does it look like behind that? So I do that quite a bit. DND headquarters is another place that I probably tried to photograph about 6 or 7 times before I found one. Actually, I've got 2 or 3 pictures that I really like. In the end, I decided to use this one because I like the tunnel and the sort of just the lack of activity going on. And I don't know, just all the graphic elements I find kind of, I don't know, it's the tunnel that sort of, I guess, does it for me.
I'm curious about the proportions you're giving your images. Some are square, some look like...
No, they're all 4 or 5. If they look square to you, it's... there's something wrong. But they're all the ratio is 4x5. Yeah, they're all pretty much full frame 4x5 images. In this thing, in my previous work, there were some square ones, there were some 4x5. The work I did with Stephanie, the Live Through This project, a lot of it was shot with like a Canon ELF, like a $300 point and shoot camera, and whatever ratio that is. Here we have, this is a government worker. Her name's Danny Donders, and I put out a call for government workers, and only one of them responded, Danielle. So I went and I took her picture. I took 2 pictures, actually. She was kind of surprised that I would only take 2 pictures, but every time you push the button, it costs $7. So you got it. And that's, to me, the beauty of partly... I mean, I'm not a digital versus film guy. I mean, like I said, you know, the project I did before this, I shot a lot of it with a $300 point and shoot. I don't really care. I just think the tool you choose affects how you approach the subject, and it maybe is more suitable. Like shooting crack houses with a 4-5, I guess you could do it if you're Bruce Davidson or something. But using a point and shoot seemed logical to me. With a 4-5, you have to make a lot of your decisions on the ground. And I really like the idea of slowing down, subtracting all the drama, and saying, okay, I'm here, where do I put the camera, and when do I push the button? So that to me, was all part of it. And when you're photographing people as well, shooting with a 4-5 really affects how they relate to the camera. That, you know, they there's a certain amount of concentration they have to have.
I'm not sure if puzzled or perturbed is the right word when you said that working 4-5 reduces or eliminates the drama you're working with. I don't know if my name's familiar to you at this point. I'm Larry Weissman. I knew you about 3 decades ago, I guess.
Okay.
So maybe you can call to mind some of my work. That doesn't really matter. I'm thinking of anything from, well, near the first decades of the medium with Negra, and then even at Jay, who was doing very quiet work, or Weston. It strikes me that there is always a great deal of drama in the image.
Oh, I'm not talking about
and
drama.
I don't know. I'd like, I guess, a clarification as to why you chose that word in describing art.
Okay. Well. First of all, I'd have to say that puzzled and what was the other word you used?
Perturbed.
Perturbed. I never mind it when I puzzle or perturb people. That's that. And if I contradict myself, I embrace that. I'm human. Just because I believe A doesn't mean that I only believe A exclusively. B can also be true. But what I meant is, I didn't mean the drama of the images, I meant the drama of how I was using the tool. It was very slow and methodical,
okay,
and sang there. So it has
okay.
nothing to do with the images, it has to do with the process.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
the whole thing.
But I also didn't want drama in the images. Like I said, everything shot on overcast days. I wanted to subtract all the drama I could. And in a weird, maybe perverse way, and I don't mind being perverse either, I think that this work, I think it's a reaction to 2 things, this work. I think it's a reaction to the work I'd done before, which was so, like, uber dramatic. And I think this is also a reaction to the current regime we have here. I often wondered if I would have done this if we'd had a more enlightened government in town. I don't know if I would or not, and I don't know if it would have looked different or not, which I think, you know, I mean, we can't know that, right? How some other eventuality might have affected how you react to something. But I mean, those are sort of metaphysical problems that I try not to think too much about because it just drives me insane. And just like when I'm working, I try to think just enough. I don't try to think too much. Usually I think too much after the fact. But while I'm working, I like to go out and just be in the moment and react to the thing. And also, I think the way I was photographing this, again, overcast, sort of dull pictures, was a reaction. Was it a reaction to, but it was a way to mirror certain aspects of this city. You know, every city has a public image. And when you look at Ottawa, it's usually reflected through the lens of its heritage, its politics, and its natural beauty. And when you look at most of the images that are about this town, you see most photographers are sort of more or less in that camp. And so what I decided to do was go, okay, there's other ways to see this. Like, how are there other ways to see this? And I think that by subtracting the drama, there's no, you know, red leaves or skaters on the canal or people, politicians going nuts on the hill. I think that's all a reaction to me wanting to just sort of show a flip side of something. And we press the right hand button. So this is a protest. I wanted to photograph a protest. I photographed three or four of them. This is a protest for missing Indigenous women. And again, this in the show is going to be 4 feet long. So these are shot with 4 or 5, and to actually go in, I don't know if you can see. This is Mo Claire and his wife. That's Paul Dewar. That's Sean Atleo. So there's all these sort of movers and shakers on Parliament Hill there. But there's also, and to me, the big question is the guy with his back to us. Who is he? I kind of think he's a security guy, but you don't know. So to me, there's a kind of. That's the tension in that picture. But again, it's essentially what I was doing with this work is I just wanted to really simply show aspects of this town that people usually overlook. And when the media covers things, they typically go with the obvious, the sentimental, and the sensational. This kind of stuff is very rarely pictured. This is an outbuilding at CSEC, the Canadian Security Establishment or Communications Security Establishment Canada, outbuilding on a Riverside Drive. These places are just there. You can go up and take pictures of them. Another interesting thing is I spent 5 years in crack houses driving around with heroin in my car, and I never got bothered by the cops once. They don't care. You start putting your camera down there, or DND, or in Rockcliffe, and you get swarmed. So I find it really interesting to see who and what the powers, the police are there to protect. Like I say, they're not too interested in the people with no power. They're interested in, you know, this stuff. And I have this really bad habit. I wish I could get over it, but I have this habit of responding in kind. And when I was photographing at the CSEC building, a security guard came up to me and said, "Where's your ID?" And I said, "Who the fuck are you? You know, leave me alone." If he'd come up and said, "Yo, dude, that's a really weird camera. Like, why are you using that?" Then he would have sucked me in. I would have just said, "Ah, it's a Linhof and I'm doing this thing." And I would have given him so much information, except he came up and played a heavy. And when you do that with me, I have this, like I say, it's this bad, bad habit to meet the person's juju that's approaching me. But I also, you know, I mean, I don't really like being talked to in that tone of voice as well. In Canada, if you're standing on a public sidewalk or in public space, you can photograph anything you can see. And it doesn't matter what it is or who it is, you're allowed to. In Quebec, if you're photographing people, there might be some issues when you publish it, but the rest of Canada, you're allowed to in public, take pictures. This is not the gulag quite yet.
Was this a parking lot or a sidewalk?
I'm standing between it's kind of a verge. There's a sidewalk to my left. I'm actually, I think, standing on a kind of a hill.
Okay.
a kind of a hill, hill type thing.
Public hill?
It's a public hill.
Yep.
This is the National Firefighters Memorial Service, and again, this is when I started to realize that you don't have to photograph the obvious things, that there's stuff that happens here, because it's the nation's capital, that no one really thinks about, or if it is reported, it's like a 20-second blurb on the, you know, evening news. So again, I went there, and I think I took two pictures or something while I was there. This looks like it could be photographed 100 years ago by August Sander, except it's in color. And you can see, you know, long exposure. You can see the guy second from the left in the front flipping through. So these are all pretty long exposures that I'm doing. This is government parking. They have to park somewhere. That's the Supreme Court in the background. When I was leaving, walking up there, a security guy, actually an RCMP guy, came up to me and said, can I help you? And I said, no, I'm okay, thanks. I just kept walking. He left me alone. That's a hunger strike. Right across from the U.S. Embassy. This is High's Steakhouse. It's a one-minute exposure. It's pretty dark in there. This is the Israeli embassy. Once again, you can't get into it. It's 50 O'Connor, I think the 15th floor. I was talking to one of the producers at Power and Politics, who was photographing for a magazine. And I had mentioned that I was doing this project, and I think I had some of my laptop on my shoulder. I said, oh, this building's right across from you. And she said, do you know that there are RCMP plainclothes people sitting in the lobby? When that building opens, from when it opens to when it closes, there's RCMP plainclothes sitting in the lobby profiling people getting on the elevator and punching the 10th floor. But again, there's a woman, I think her name's Taryn Simon, who is an American photographer. She photographs things, I think, a lot like this, that without a caption, they're sort of meaningless, or the caption adds a lot of meaning. Without a caption, this is just a boring picture looking up at a building. But when you say Israeli embassy, it, I think, changes how you react to it. And I'm not using this. The New York Times did a thing about this a couple of years ago, and in the interview, that's what I said. And then some woman wrote in and said, you know, why are you picking on the Jewish state? And I said, I don't typically reply to comments, but in this case, I felt I wanted to because it was just sort of so egregious. I said, well, no, that was just an example of how when you label something, it changes how people. It could have been the American embassy, or it could have been a view of a government building. You know, this is like a boring landscape with a building in it, but when you say it's building number 19, you know, Health Canada, it changes how people react to it. But again, that's so all the images in the newspaper and in the show are definitely titled, and the titles have something to do with what they're about. And again, this is just sort of, I walked to the corner, aimed the camera up, and there just happened to be that sort of black shape, which was reflecting a building across the way.
No one approached you on that image?
No. Jeffrey Simpson? Sorry?
Your profile.
I'm pretty sure. I have a picture of the front of the American Embassy. It was a place I tried to photograph three or four times too, and I ended up just photographing it square on from the front, and there's a big camera there. And I was outside there, you know, trying to line things up for probably 10 minutes. So I'm pretty sure they have way more pictures of me than I have of them.
I've heard of people trying to photograph the American Embassy, and they'll stop you from doing it.
Who's they?
Well, these are photographers that I know.
No, but who tries to stop them?
The guards, the guy that works the guard. Anyway, I've been told people will.
They'll try lots of.
Yeah. Well, they try. No, the police are within their rights to come up and suggest you don't do it, and they use the verbal judo. Right, they've been trained how to manipulate you. So what you have to be aware of is that they are manipulating you, and what you have to understand is your rights and freedoms. And then when you counter, with your rights and freedoms, they no longer have. And in fact, this happened outside the CSEC building. The guard came up and gave me a hard time, and then I sort of barked back at him, and there was a bit of a an argument, and then he went in to phone. He says, "I'm going to phone the police." And I said, "Yeah, phone the police. I don't care. Phone the police." And then his boss talked to him, and he came out, the first guy, came back, and he handed me a card, and he said, "If you have any questions, just phone this number. Thank you very much. Sorry for bothering you." So what he was doing is if someone could bully you into stopping, and you stop, they win. And it's like Bill C-51, I don't know if anyone here is a conservative or not, but you know, you can probably tell from my thing, I'm not. And you know, this government, more than many others, I think, has used that tactic of bullying, and we're going to do what we want, and you're all too fat and comfortable to stand up on your back legs and push back. So we're just going to roll over you. So it's not their fault. It's your fault. And I include myself in there. This is Juno, the mascot of the Canadian Army.
What about Jeffrey Simpson?
That was actually shot for a magazine. There's a couple pictures in here that I shot for magazines that I ended up using in this, because a lot of the magazine work I get, I'm photographing, you know, certain top floor corner office people. This is the celebration of the 60th anniversary of the Korean Armistice. And this is working with a 4-5. And I sort of figure out where I have to be, put the camera down, put the thing over, focus it, and then take a picture. And it probably, from when I put the camera down to when I take the picture, might take a minute or a minute and a half. Got to be really fast, because this stuff doesn't last that long. And then you sort of set it up and you wait. It's like, okay, what are they going to do? And then they saluted, I pushed the button. And then it's not like you're shooting 8 frames a second. You get like one chance
at
it.
If you're working like that, do you not do anything handheld?
No, I'm working with a Linhof on a ground glass.
I know you're working with a Linhof. With Technica?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it does have a rangefinder and a thing, but... But that, to me...
They were used by photojournalists
right,
through the 50s.
Yeah. That's not how I wanted to use it. I wanted to use it in a slow ground glass kind of way. So this is the Prime Minister's limo. I had photographed Bruno Sacomani, who used to be the chief of the Prime Minister's protection. He's an RCMP guy. I photographed him for a magazine. And we kind of hit it off. It was kind of funny. It must have been 2010 when I photographed him, and in the fall, and we sort of made the thing, and I rolled up to Sussex Drive, and they let me in, and Bruno came over, and he's a very gracious guy. He's some ambassador now. He got some kind of foreign affairs thing, but I just won the Karsh Award, and I had a bunch of shows, and he sort of came up to me and said, "Wow, a lot of stuff happening for you these days." And I said, "How do you know?" And he says, "We Googled you." But I kind of think they have Google Plus or something. Like, I'm pretty sure they have a deeper Google than we have. Anyway, a couple of years later, when I started this project, I wanted to photograph the limo. So he sent Bruno an email, and 10 minutes later, my phone rings, and he goes, "Tony, Bruno." I said, "Wow, that's fast." He goes, "Yeah." He says, "What do you need?" And I said, "Well, I need the limo and a place to shoot it." He says, "Where do you want to shoot it?" And I said, "I don't care, as long as it's in the shade, because I don't want it to be in the sun." He says, "You want some men with it?" And I said, "Yeah, a couple men." He says, "Do you want a secure location?" And I said, "Sure." And he goes, "Location 1. I said, "What does that mean?" He goes, "24 Sussex." He says, "Next Thursday at 10 o'clock. Boom, just like that. For this personal project, I'm at 24 Sussex photographing, you know, the men in black.
That's location 1.
Yeah, location 1. Marg Yalahunty, a satirical news character. This is a monument at the corner of Wellington Street, and that would be Lyon, I suppose. Again, I photographed that a few times, but it was when the thing on the left. I just love the weird juxtaposition of what's covered and what's not covered. And again, this is stuff we walk by or drive by all the time, and I don't think I've ever seen anyone walk up to that and have a look at it. Government buildings. shot at probably 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning. In my car, next to my tripod, I have an orange safety vest. And when I do stuff like this, and also I use it for my commercial work, I put on the vest, and people will obey you. And if you really want to be thorough about it, you would have a hard hat and a clipboard. But I had to photograph a truck for someone, and they wanted it on Slater Street. And they said, well, we'll park it next to the curb so we don't interrupt traffic. So they did that. It was like a 3-ton truck or something. I don't even know why they want it. Anyway, and I said, no, it can't be next to the curb because it just looks stupid. We have to move it out into the traffic. So they said, okay, well, how are we going to do that? So I was working with an assistant because it was a commercial job. And I said to Ben, get the things. And we put them on, and he just went out there, stopped traffic for 5 minutes, and people went around, and we took a picture of the truck. And so that is actually an excellent photo accessory to have, is an orange safety vest and a clipboard. It's amazing.
They tend not to drive over you when you happen to.
Yeah, yeah. And I actually do it. I wasn't worried about anything there except getting hit. You know, I mean, I try not to. I mean, I have a bit of a death wish, but... Yeah. This is the National Press Building. And I was lucky enough when I was shooting this that all along Wellington they were doing renos and buildings were wrapped. And this building, I don't know if you can tell from there, but it's wrapped in burlap. And again, I love the idea, just like the picture of the monument, of things covered, official things covered, and the skins on them, which make them less permeable, more opaque, even though it's the press building. This is the opening of Parliament. Wait, they look like cattle pens.
It draws a crowd.
Sorry?
It draws a crowd.
It draws a crowd, yeah. It draws a crowd, the opening of Parliament. And again, I can't believe how much those look like cattle pens. Yeah. Or maybe a sheep pen. This is Debbie DeVoe. She's the president of CPIP, the professional... the union of professional people in the civil service. And I had emailed her or her assistant and explained what I was doing and asked if she would be interested in being photographed because I wanted to show sort of the rank and file side as well. Can you call the union president rank and file? Is that rank and file?
Sure.
Okay. This is the prime minister's office, the Langevin block. It looks like he's burning the midnight oil, but I've actually been in that room, and that's the orange light is actually the hallway. His office is to the right. It's the two windows to the right.
No light on.
Yeah, with no light on. This is the tank.
Mirrored glass.
Yeah. Tank, leopard tank on Parliament Hill.
What was that?
Is that on the shooting?
Sorry?
Was that on the day of the shootings on the
No, that was on the day of the victory celebration, victory quote-unquote celebration of the end of the Canadian involvement in Afghanistan. There was like marches up, I sort of covered that whole thing of soldiers marching and stuff like that. But they had a howitzer up there and a tank and stuff like that. You don't really need to know that though, because to me it's when I talked earlier about quiet symbolism. This is not so quiet, but to me it's quite symbolic. That's Pierre Poilievre, the minister for Nepean or something. And again, I had phoned him up or emailed him and asked if I could take his picture. And I had photographed him early on, and I thought at that point I might be shooting some people inside, and then I realized that I wasn't going to. So then I emailed him again, said, no, that picture I took sucks, I don't really like it, can I photograph you again? And he said yes. And funnily enough, when I asked him to stand there in that position, he said, what, you want me with my back against the wall? And I said yeah. And I sort of looked creepy if you... I mean, he can only look creepy, right? Yeah. This is Stephen Poloz, the chairman of Make Canada. This was shot for a report on Business Magazine. Shot with my 4-5 for them. This is the set of Power and Politics, Evan Solomon's show. And when I had emailed them and asked if I could photograph the set. The producer, it took a couple days and they came back and said, yeah, you can come in, you know, like almost any morning is good. And when I went in, I asked the producer who was minding me, actually it wasn't a producer, it was someone else minding me, but I asked them, like, why am I here? Like, what discussion did you have? And she said there was four people sitting at a table looking at your work, and we decided that we would support what you were doing. So I thought that was kind of cool.
When you approach these people, do you send them proofs of what you've already done?
With this project, I would attach 3 or 4 JPEGs to the email, but I would always direct them. I'm not interested in pulling fast ones. And like, for instance, with Debbie DeVoe, the union leader, I sent her a 300-word email once she said she was going to do it, outlining what I was trying to do with the project. Because I'm not interested in saying, yeah, I'm doing this, and then it turns out to be something else. I think that's just bad karma, bad for your karma. So I'm always up front, just like when I'm working commercially. If I have to photograph you, we set you up, we take 10 or 15 pictures, and we all go over to the computer and look at them. And then we go back and do some more. And so I'm definitely not interested pulling a fast one. Yeah, I want to make sure that the people understand in broad terms what I'm trying to do. I think that that's just polite.
Are you getting release form from those folks?
For these, no.
But like the lady and so on, no, right?
No. I don't need them. They're in public. They're in public, and they've obviously agreed to do it. So yeah, I mean, when I was working with the drug thing, I was getting release forms all the time. And when I go to like the American South or to the States to photograph, I always get releases, but in this case I'm not. This is the Governor General's residence. Again, I was there 3 or 4 times trying to figure out how to photograph it, and there's this picture, and then there's another picture of a rock with a plaque on it, and I was sort of kept wavering which one. But in the end I just sort of liked, I think, the graphic quality of this. Plus I like the idea of the, I mean, I don't know if you can see, but where they're standing and then in the background, which is out of focus, is actually where they're standing. And I love the idea of the representation of something, in a way, an idealized representation that the government's putting forward. And again, simple pictures. There's like nothing too tricky about these at all. This is the Russian
Embassy. Sorry, that last picture there, I mean, was that an image on the truck
itself? Yeah, it's an image on a truck. That's a like a semi-truck.
And that's
the back of it, and they drive around. I think it's like a little museum type thing. They drive around Canada, and people can go and soak up the
objects. I was there when it was open one time. They got little stairs that you walk up into the thing.
Yeah. So I'm not, with these, I'm not actually interested in showing what something. Well, I mean, I am interested in simply showing what something is, but I don't want them to be really super descriptive. I mean, I want them to be just sort of flat information. But I'm also, even though I said trying to think, in a way, boring pictures, I don't want them to be too boring. I want them to be maybe some little flick or twist. I mean, that is kind of like, that picture's a kind of a mind. It plays with your mind because you can't quite figure out what it is when you first look at it. And especially with those two crop marks on the top of the truck, it's like, what is that all about?
It almost looks like you fully shopped that.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the Russian Embassy. Prime Minister Harper with Vladimir Putin.
Did you get any flack?
No, they was just, that's a billboard they have outside there.
Oh, but still, you were in front of them.
Yeah, no, yeah.
No. No, they weren't.
No. I've actually been in that embassy a while ago, and it was kind of, it's like walking into a time warp. Like, it's like sort of walking into, I've never been to Moscow, but what I would assume would be Moscow in 1974 or something. The wallpaper's really weird, and there's like very nice ground floor, and then there's a sort of barred entrance to the stairs to the second floor. And I think I was photographing the Russian ambassador or something, and I said to this guy, I really think his name was Igor, the guy who was minding me. I said, Igor, can I go and look in the second floor? He goes, no second floor. This is the security checkpoint on the west side of Parliament Hill. Used to be you could just drive on Parliament. I remember when I had shoots up there, I'd just drive, park in a senator's spot, because the senators are never there, right? And even if you got a ticket, I think it was like $8 or something. But those days are now long gone. But I just sort of like the two, no man walking. And
no people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I was at the 3 days ago, I was at the American ambassador's house, and before actually photographing his wife for Canadian Art Magazine, because she's really into art. And she's actually, we walked into one room that she'd sort of curated, and it was all pictures about race in America. There were photographs. It was and there was a Chuck Close painting. But it was unbelievable. There was pictures from Selma, pictures from the garbage strike in Memphis, modern pictures. She's like, she really understands what she's doing, and it was kind of interesting to see it. But before we went, both me and my assistant had to supply information to the FBI. When we pulled up, they got the mirror out and looked under her car. We had to pop the hood of the trunk before they would let us in. The previous time I was at the ambassador's house, which was only about 5 years ago, none of that happened. I drove up. I got out of the car. There was no one around. I got my light stand bag out, which looks like it could hold a recoilless rifle or something, and started wandering around, and no one paid any attention until I saw this woman walking across the lawn with a dog, and it turned out to be the ambassador's wife. And she said, "You coming in?" I said, "Yeah." She says, "Come on in." So we went in. I mean, there might have been a sniper in the tree. I don't know. Sorry?
To the one hut guy.
Yeah. Government signage, just like really plain and simple. This is the taxation center on Data Road. I spent about 4 or 5 times trying to photograph the Revenue Building downtown, which is this magnificent sort of neo-Gothic structure. You've seen it on Sussex there. And got a couple of pictures I kind of liked, but then I decided that I would just sort of go to the outlying area and photograph a satellite building from Revenue Canada. There were certain sort of elements of the Canadian government I wanted to represent.
The parking lot is symbolic too.
Yeah. This is Tiny's Pasture. And again, you know, essentially a boring picture of nothing until discover what's called government buildings. And I should say that this too, the idea of giving this work away free to people, typically when I do an exhibition or a book, the people that buy it and support it are people that know and support my work. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to sort of move outside that and maybe sneak up on people and say, okay, here's, you know, you never see these bits of Ottawa. Like I want these newspapers to be left in dentists' offices in Edmonton and at bus stops in Victoria. You know, so people just bump into them and flip through. And I'm sure that 90% of the people will pick it up, flip through, and say, what is this shit, and throw it away. But if there's 10%, even if there's 5% that sort of get nudged 2 degrees and go, oh, I never thought of it like that, then I consider that a job well done. And I mean, I know that Jake was talking recently about the idea of prints versus online presence and other means of distribution. And I'm really interested in those aspects of photography as well, looking at how Marshall McLuhan said the medium is the message, and I don't understand that, and I don't think anyone understands it, except I think everyone has a sort of inkling of an almost idea of what it means. So my inkling is that, for instance, if you're posting pictures on Facebook, I mean, that's a specific medium, and it's kind of disposable, and you go with sort of like a water cooler, you flip through, so people will pay your pictures a certain kind of attention there. But then if you do a concise edited gallery on your website and direct people to it, I think the people will look at it. It'll have more weight. First of all, the pictures will be bigger. There'll be less noise around them. And I think people will react to the pictures in a more serious way. And then if your pictures get published in like Lens Blog or one of the big blogs online, where there's typically an article that a third person has written, I think that they get looked at differently again. So, and then if you show them in a gallery, they get looked at a certain way. But if you're doing a newsprint publication, they'll be looked at another way. And I think it's really fascinating how all those tentacles go out, and by trying to control how you're distributing your images, you can actually, I think, in a tiny way, You can never follow your work around and police it. You can never do that. But in a tiny way, I think you can nudge how people's expectations. I think that that's possible by choosing the means of distribution that might be sort of righteous for what you're trying to do. I've kind of gone off the idea of a print as a precious object. I think partly because no one buys my prints except institutions, but no one really wants pictures of, you know, the Israeli embassy or a crack addict hanging there on their wall. So I thought, okay, I don't need to do it that way. And besides, I mean, except for maybe Louis, who I think you sell a lot of prints.
Not enough, but I can sell some.
Yeah, but I think, you know, for someone to actually, unless you're, who's the guy from Toronto, Bertinsky, or someone like that, you know, selling these prints for, you know, $45,000 or whatever they are, you're never going to make money by doing fine art prints and selling them. You're always going to be in the hole. So I decided to just sort of negate, in a way, that whole aspect of my practice, although I am showing the work at the Ottawa Art Gallery this summer, but only because they offered me a show in the belly of the beast at City Hall, where the Annex Gallery is. My initial plan for the work was to approach the Bank Street Business BIA, Business Improvement, and I was going to ask the woman there, she's quite a mover and shaker from what I've read about her, and I was going to ask her if I could have two blocks of windows on one side of the street, consecutive store windows, and I was going to hang my show, like, so you'd be walking by Wicked Wanda's and you'd sort of look up and there'd be this and another picture and you go, what? And then you go to the next store and there'd be some more work from this. So it was going to be sort of me facing the street and just bumping into people walking by. I'm still going to hold that idea in my mind for maybe future shows. I have friends that do newsprint publications and they wheat paste them all over the world. They send them to people and ask them to wheat paste them. Rob Hornstra, who did the Saatchi Project, he's having all these monster shows in museums, and probably a third of the work he's showing are newsprint images that come from the newspapers he produces that are wheat pasted onto gallery walls. And you can, because they're wheat pasted, you can actually see the image on the other side. So he's going, yeah, this is not about precious objects. This is about information and distribution. So by how he's handling museum shows, he's giving you hints about what he thinks the work might be about, or maybe how you should consume it. He says it's not fine art; it's journalism. And again, that's with the official Ottawa thing. The reason I wanted to do a newspaper was because when you pick up a newspaper, it's kind of has these loaded subtexts of news and entertainment, slightly disposable, and mostly news and entertainment. And I wanted the pictures to be presented with that in mind. Yeah. Yeah. And like I say, probably a lot of people will go, the fuck is this? And then other people will go, what? So, but anyway, this here, I've been to this, that's all an aside. I've been to trying to photograph Tiny's Pasture for like 2 years. And again, this is how what a slow learner I am. But it also is about serendipity and an open mind. And one day, Cindy, my wife, and I were coming back from, I think, the Parkdale Market, and I missed the turn that I normally take. So I turned left. I think this is Parkdale, but I'm not sure. And, sorry?
Holland,
okay. So we're driving down Holland. I probably would have turned down Parkdale, or whatever it was. So, and then I'm coming up to the stoplight, and I go, this is the picture. It's like, I don't know if I've driven by it a lot of times, but it reminded me a lot of what happened with the CPC headquarters. It's like, you know, all you got to do is just sort of bump into it. So again, a Sunday morning with my red vest on. This is a building in Tiny's Pasture. This is actually going to be the cover of the book, because I think it sort of sums everything up. It's the front of the Embassy of the United States. I love it that everything's lined up, but it's on a hill, so the thing is just slightly askew, which I kind of like. And you can see it's the National War Museum. And I like the idea of the faceless soldiers. It's West Block. Again, covered up. I love that idea of the covered up and held up by scaffolding. But the beauty of the 4.5.2 is that, I mean, you know, you can shoot stuff like that, and I use the rise and everything. So even when, I guess you can do that in Photoshop. I don't know how to do it, but I know you can. But when you do stuff like that, I think even the look of the image is sort of, there's something kind of a little unsettling about it, because we're not used to seeing things looking up at something with not whatever this is called. What's that called? When it goes like that. No, not parallax, but the weird perspective, yeah.
Tony?
Yeah.
You want to go back to that one?
Yeah.
It's kind of funny in a backwards way. This reminds me, Christo put a cover around the ice top in Germany.
Yeah.
And I know my family's from Berlin, and I know some of them were very opposed to that. Some they found that real affront somehow. But then when it actually happened, they loved it. Because it drew attention to this building in a way, in a very different way than you normally thinks of it. And but drawing attention to it, it became a symbol in a positive, very positive way. It became a focal point for the community.
That's interesting. Because I would guess that initially, sorry to interrupt, but initially they probably thought, how dare you take this symbol and prettify it or artify it or something?
Yeah, they just didn't like the idea. They were conservative, small C in a sense. But then they loved it. It became a place to go out and picnic and whatever while this was up. And it's always... It's temporary. And what's interesting about this is I've seen, of course, we've all seen that, and I've seen that before too. You know, the coverings here, and but we don't see it, as you point out. But now by bringing it up this way, you're actually seeing the building. You're actually seeing the building in a way that you've never seen it before if it weren't covered. I'm repeating your point in a way. But you're doing it by taking the photograph of it, whereas Christo, in a sense, did it deliberately.
Right. And then other people took photos of it.
Yeah, exactly. But we don't acknowledge this as being a sort of a conscious sort of act to bring attention to the thing that's
right.
Underneath it.
Yeah.
This is just, but the photograph then makes that thing conscious.
Yeah, I mean, all this work, I mean, conscious is a good word. Typically, I try to be kind of unconscious when I'm working. But this work, I think, was very conscious. In terms of how I executed it and what I photographed and how I photographed it. They've unwrapped the north sort of third of that building now. If you're driving by, it is gorgeous. It's been sandblasted. All the little red details around the windows are this beautiful brick red. I think it's going to be really, really gorgeous when it's done. But it doesn't suit my symbolism.
Just as an aside, I actually spoke to somebody that did work on the masonry years ago. And the reason why they actually put the scaffolding or covered it is because if passerbyers saw them taking the stones out away from the building, they would say, oh, you're destroying our building.
Really?
And as a way of just being able to work and work without the soldiers being outraged, and that's why they covered it.
Well, I thought it was to keep them warm.
That's all possible, but no. Yeah. It's
interesting.
See,
if you look at recent pictures from Washington, D.C., the Capitol building, the dome is now completely covered in scaffolding as well. They're doing renovations there. So this is an advertisement. Only in Ottawa would you see ads for F-35s. It's like, what do you want for Christmas? Well, I was going to go to Howard Jeweler and ask for a ring, but I think I'd have an F-35 instead. So I thought it was so typical of Ottawa. These are people hanging banners on Confederation Boulevard. In front of the Embassy of Kuwait, yeah. This is the RCMP headquarters. And again, this image here, I was just driving by, coming back from somewhere, and I saw that happening, and I sort of hopped out of my car, set up the camera really quickly, and took a picture. Should have backed up about 5 feet, but didn't. It's the RCMP headquarters. I pulled in there. This is the new one on LinkedIn. They used to be not JetForm, but JDS Uniphase, the headquarters. And the RCMP have moved their old headquarters over off wherever that is.
Trombley
Road, yeah, which is a much more sinister looking place. It's got like the buffalo heads and everything's sort of this dark stone. But this is the new one. And there's no parking around there. And I didn't really want to park on the street. So I pulled into the booth, and the guard there said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I want to take a picture of the thing. Can I park in the parking lot? And he goes, yeah. So, you know, like Blanche DuBois in A Streetcar Named Desire, a lot of what I do relies on the kindness of strangers. Not so much this kind of work, but the portraiture. You know, I go up to these complete strangers and say, will you work with me while I recontextualize you, which is essentially what I'm saying. And they go, okay, which I find... But they only go okay if... it's not like I don't blurt it out. We get out of the car, we start talking to them, and there's like 15 minutes of conversation. It's like, you're from Canada? Because I shoot a lot in the States. And I go, yeah. And a woman in Ohio says, you have cities up there? I said, yeah, that's the typical American. But the one thing every American knows about Canada is that we have free health care. You can go into go into Panther Burn, Mississippi, and talk to someone there, and they go, you got free health care, huh? They know it.
That's why it's not like Canadian state.
So I think that and I show when I'm photographing people, I always bring samples of my work, and we shoot Polaroids. I'll give them a Polaroid, and I get their address, and I send them a print when I'm done. It's quite logistically daunting, but I think it's only fair to do that. But if you're years and years and years ago, I was in Florida doing a shoot, and there was me and my assistant and the head of the ad agency, an account exec, and I guess that was it. And we had a half a day off before we were going to fly home. And what I did is I went to Tampa into some neighborhood, and I met people and hung out on porches and took portraits. And when we're flying home, Bob, the guy who owned the agency who considers himself a photographer, said to me, what did you do this afternoon? I said, oh, I went into some neighborhoods in Tampa and met a bunch of people. And then later I showed him the pictures. When I said, what did you do? He says, I went and looked at yachts. So the next year, this was a shoot for AT&T. The next year we're back again doing the same thing. We're photographing snowbirds. And he, on a day off, Bob, decided that rather than look at yachts, what he was going to do is he was going to go into the neighborhood and take pictures. And he did, but no one let him take the picture. And it's because he only liked the idea of going and taking pictures. He wasn't righteous. He was, and people can tell that, is if you actually, if you need to and are genuine about it, people will sense that, and they'll let you. But if you're doing it for some, I won't say selfish reason, because I mean the only reason I do it is for selfish reasons. But if you're doing it for some reason that is not genuine, I think people will know. And I know in my practice, and even stuff like this, having the guy let me in and to park there, all you got to do is ask. All you got to do is have a conversation with people. And, contrary to the police and the security guys coming up and saying, show your ID, and then like a pit bull, I go for their throat. Typically, I'm very interested in just getting along with people and having conversations, and they tell me stuff and I tell them stuff. And I'm speaking of Panther Burn, I met a woman named Moby Tillis in Panther Burn, Mississippi. And I asked her if she'd lived. We were sitting on the steps of her trailer, and I said, if you lived in Panther Burn all your life? And she said, well, I was born here, and me and Leroy got married here, but then we moved to Chicago because there was no work here. And then we're in Chicago for years working, and then my mama got sick. And I says to Leroy, I got to go back to Panther. They don't say Panther Burn, they call it Panther Boyne. I says, I got to go back to Panther Boyne because my mama's sick. And Leroy says to me, he says, I ain't going back there. He says, I'm staying in Chicago. And then she looks at me, she says, so I left her. She says, you can always get another man, but you ain't got but one mama. This is just like sitting on a stoop in Panther Burn, Mississippi. I've got a million of those. And that's, I think, the reason that I mostly, this is a bit of an aberration. I think the reason I mostly take pictures is to get out of the house and have social interaction. And the camera is a kind of it's a license to go these places and to meet these people and to interact with them. And the way I shoot is I don't just say stand there. I go, well, let's go somewhere where the light's nice. And, do you have a sister? For non-creepy reasons. Okay, we'll go somewhere. And I go, no, I don't like this. The background sucks. So what I'm doing is I'm making demands of the subject. And what that does is they don't disrespect me because I'm making demands. They respect me. because I'm saying this is not good enough. I want this to be better. I'm serious about this. And what that does is then they start to buy into the idea of working with this stranger, because he seems to be going out of his way to demand things. So often you think as a photographer, oh, you know, I can't take too much of their time, or I shouldn't talk to them, or I shouldn't do this, or I shouldn't do that. I think that's like really defeatist, and that to actually move forward, what you have to do is, especially if you're a portrait photographer, which there's hardly any portraits here, but that's my history, is you make demands of yourself and demands of your subject. And when you do that, the space between you shrinks. And when the space shrinks, there's much more likelihood of a spark passing. And when that spark passes, everyone knows it. And it's kind of like taking drugs, which I don't do anymore. Again, I was on my way to photograph something else, and there was this roadblock on Elgin Street, and I thought, oh, fuck, I got to go around now. And I thought, no, Tony, don't be stupid. Take a picture of it. So get out, take the picture. And I love there's all these details in here, but there's a shadow just on the left under the bridge that I think is really a silhouette of a person, which I think is really kind of sweet. This is a special event in Ottawa where the army was meeting to march somewhere, I think. And again, working with a 4 or 5, but working really quickly, you know, sort of running over, setting it up, framing the shot, and standing there sort of looking at the people going, okay. And I think that at a certain point, the man, the last sort of pale blue guy on the right turned around and sort of put his hands on. I thought, okay, that's... can't organize everyone, but that seems pretty organized to me.
Like the security cameras.
Yeah. Supreme Court, and again, like the Governor General's thing, it's like a blocked edifice with a representation in front of it. I've got a lot of pictures of the Supreme Court. There's a really nice view from just around the east side, the parking lot facing it. It looks very decrepit, and all the signs are bust and stuff. But everyone shows the Supreme Court. They either do the really wide angle, the press guys, the wide angle with the Supreme Court sign coming out, or they just do that, or they do the statue of like the hooded lady holding the scales.
So you must have photoshopped the little blocks underneath the sign.
Photoshopped?
Yeah, for sure.
Oh yeah.
They're too good.
Yeah. tourists. Might be the last picture. I think it's the last picture. Yep. So, okay. Stop.
Go on. Oh my
God, no.
Yeah.
Do
no,
this.
Although.
There.
Yeah.
So, that's that. Yeah. Anyone have questions, complaints? Concerns. Yeah.
Could you perhaps to expand on what you were talking about just with the last few images, could you describe what the meaning of this set of images is for you?
I probably could, but I don't know if I want to. One of the things I've discovered in my career is that what you intend and what happens or how it's perceived are never the same thing. So I'm not exactly sure I want to tell people. I mean, I think I've talked about it a little, the quiet symbolism and the politics and sort of showing things, stuff like that. But in terms of broader meaning, I mean, I could tell you what it means to me. But I think in the end, the only thing that's important is what you take away from it. And I'm not entirely sure that I would want to nail something down to saying this is supposed to mean that. I mean, not to give you short shrift or anything, but that's, I mean, I for the longest time, I tried to explain myself, and then I realized that it's just sort of like pissing into the wind, you know, because like I said, you can't follow your work around and police it. if you're a conservative, you might look at this set of images one way. If you're an anarchist, you would look at it another way. And far be it from me to tell you how you're supposed to react. The only hope...
So you don't see that any part of the purpose of an image is to make an editorial statement about the thing that's...
I think that there is a lot of editorializing in here, but I don't really want to spell it out. E.E. Cummings, the poet, was at giving a poetry reading in the 50s, and he read one of his poems, and a woman in the audience put up her hand and said, "Can you tell me what it means?" And she said, and he said to her, "In other words, you want me to say it worse?" So that is sort of how I'm looking at this. These are nonverbal. This is a nonverbal form of communication. I'm using words to talk about it. But I think that the beauty of a nonverbal form of communication is that it goes into your head and gets it, if they're any good or if the person's interested in what you're dealing with, it gets knocked around in there, and maybe a conclusion or a half a conclusion or an inkling gets arrived at. And I think that that's the best and most you can hope for from a set of photographs, is that it goes into someone's head and actually rattles around a little.
Well, I was thinking in terms of, to give a hypothetical, if you were to ask Bob Kappa what are your pictures about, he would certainly be able to say in about five words they're about the horrors of war.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious as to what your own feelings about your own images.
Oh, well, I can say, I mean, if you want a thumbnail, which I think that saying they're about the horrors of war is shorthand, and anytime you use shorthand, I think you're giving short shrift to the breadth of what you've done. But I could say this is about the federal manifest, how the federal presence manifests itself in Ottawa. I mean, that's the sort of the Twitter version of this. But just like Robert Capa's pictures are not just about the horrors of war, they're about many other things. So if you go and look at Robert Capa and only filter them through the idea of these are about the horrors of war, you're going to exclude all the other meanings that those images might have. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Tony, like I'm new in doing photography, and one thing that I noticed when I was looking at your share finance thing there.
The Kickstarter, yeah.
You're paying someone $400 to do an editorial for writing a text. And this is something that I truly believe in, like getting someone that is outside of my project and asking them to write about what I'm doing.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure that I know why I'm doing it, but I know it's important. Maybe you know why you're doing it.
Well, no, I'm often wrong. I'm in this sort of charmed position now where brainiacs look at my work and write about it. And then I read what they write, and I go, oh, that's what I was doing? Or it's like, didn't know I was doing that. It's always really interesting to read what a curator or a journalist or a photo editor writes about your work, or a critic, although the critics are usually the worst. But and I don't mean in terms of them slagging the work, but in terms of them getting it what I consider sort of wrong a lot, or getting sort of running away with one detail. Oh, this is about this, and then they seem to forget, you know, nuance. But when and I guess, you know, this happens with Louis too, I would assume your work sort of out there and people are writing about it and you're sort of going, oh, I didn't know I did that, or well, maybe you did know you did it, maybe
but,
you're like way smarter.
You hired someone. That the point that I'm trying to get to is you hired someone to write.
Yeah.
In terms of your material, in terms of the package you're delivering,
yeah,
what was your intent with respect to getting this person to write something? Like,
well, Phil Jenkins is a historian mostly, and a musician. So I thought bringing a historian in, and he writes about architecture for The Citizen as well. I've known Phil for 30 years. We go way back. We've worked on projects together way back when. He would write and I would take pictures. We haven't worked together for a long time. But I thought, okay, I'm going to ask Phil to write about this. And the only thing I asked him was to not be too factual. But I have no idea. I asked him for 300 words. So I don't want this treatise on what this work's about. I want, I think, a kind of an atmosphere. I don't know what he's going to write. But, I mean, we had a discussion. I said I want it to be kind of atmospheric and illusional rather than nailing things down, saying this is what you're supposed to be seeing. I want it to be a peripheral to the work or a parallel to it, but not right on top of it. Yeah. So, I mean, again, I don't know what he's going to write. I haven't seen it. But that, to me, just sort of brings in, hopefully, it'll bring in a kind of a poetic, allusional take on. I mean, I don't even know if he's going to write about the pictures or about living in Ottawa or not living in Ottawa. I don't know what he's going to write about. But it's just sort of this other sort of someone coming from a slightly other direction, saying, okay, here's the pictures, and then here's someone sort of writing around them. So again, you know, I'm a little scared because I don't know what he's going to write, and I don't know whether I'm going to think it moves the thesis forward or impairs the thesis. I don't know, but
it's not marriage.
No, it's not marriage, and
but you'll pay him anyway.
Yeah, I'll pay him anyway. Yeah, and I've never been adverse to risk. I've always believed in saying, yeah, let's try this and see what happens, rather than saying, maybe I'll just stay in and watch YouTube, you know, and then that's, although I stay in and watch YouTube as well. But no, I've always, I think in my practice, I've always erred on the side of being crazy rather than being sane.
But I think, today, the reason why I do it is because there are things that we do that we don't know why, and we don't even know we do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And having a person that is completely outside of photography or will bring a perspective to the viewers that, you know, like you just said, you will discover yourself, and it will allow the viewer to, you know, take a second look at the images, mm-hmm. and look at it again and figure out something. But I think it's important to do this sort of stuff when you're doing a series.
I mean, the book I did before this with Stephanie, yeah. There was a 12-page book in the back. She wrote the words. It was this heroin addict that I was working with. And she told the story from her perspective. And if you read her story and look at the pictures, there's certain points of crossover, but there's also lots of points where she's fleshing out details that I didn't put in the book for whatever reason. She's talking about her life before I met her. She's talking about her life after I met her. So it's not saying, you know, this is what's happening. She's saying, this is my story. And then the photographs say, this is my story. And the way the book was designed, the reason we put her words in a booklet was because I wanted the booklet to be a separate thing, so you could take it out, so the two stories could exist independently. You could leave the book downstairs and leave the pamphlet upstairs if you wanted. I think probably most people keep them together, but to me the symbolism of that was important. That here's two stories, and they're together, but they can also be pulled apart. This is what she thinks, and this is what I think. So I think there's a little nuance that you can add to your work that maybe people won't verbalize. Oh, he wanted them to be separate, but I do think that you can go into the back of a person's brain. I think that's where you want to be. When you take pictures that only exist in the front of someone's brain, it's too easy to spit them out. But if you're in the back of someone's brain somehow, if you can worm your way in there, then what happens is they gotta sort of worm its, they have to do something to worm its way out again, right? So, and it's that sort of worming of the stuff that you're trying to put into people's heads that I think is where the action, that's where the action's at. And I think mostly the way I do it is through editing. I think that the reason I take pictures is to get out of the house. But what I really like about taking pictures is having this stack of what I call raw data, which is the images, and then whittling and whittling and whittling and whittling and whittling until it takes a really concise shape that goes as far as I can make it go towards supporting my thesis. But because it's nonverbal, I don't really want to nail my thesis down too much. So it's this very fine balancing act. Less so with this. I mean, this is a 45 image edit from about 250 pictures, I guess. The Stephanie thing was, I think, a 38 image edit from maybe about 5,000 pictures. And that was a story I could have taken anyway, one way or another. And in fact, I just I killed my blog about a year ago and then did a book. It's actually a book that flips. One side is called Attack and Confusion. And it's excerpts from the blog, mostly about me shooting User. But then when you flip it, when I was shooting the Stephanie thing, I don't know if any of you were reading it, but as that was happening, I was blogging it. Every week, I would have this blog. And one of the blog titles was Dead. And it sort of talks about me driving down the street and seeing Stephanie, and she didn't look right, and I came over and said, what's wrong? And she said, Corey died of an overdose, a fentanyl overdose, 2 days ago. They found him in the washroom, and he was dead. Corey was her boyfriend. And I said, oh, that sucks. Are you okay? She says, yeah, I just got to go get some drugs. And then she left. And then I'd given Stephanie a point and shoot, and she had taken a picture of Corey that was all blurry. And that week, it just said dead, and it told the story, and there was a picture of Corey. So what I did on the flip side of this book is called Asleep and Waking Up, and it's excerpts from those journals I was keeping while I was photographing that project. So it's essentially a diary, a blow-by-blow, a day-by-day of what was going on, and then it actually goes about a year into the future after we did the book. It talks about what happened to Stephanie once the book was done. So I mean, there's all these different ways you can tell a story. This one, there weren't so many ways because it was a kind of wasn't so open-ended. But with the Stephanie story, lots of ways. With the crack addict portraits, there was less ways to tell a story because it was portraiture. So I had to figure out, okay, how can I take these portraits and sort of make some kind of cohesive arc out of them? So I mean, I think each unless you shoot the same thing over and over and over. And then sort of go, okay, well, this is how it always goes. If you're exploring new things using new tools and approaches, which I like to do, then I think every time you come to a conclusion, and the conclusions are the scariest bits, saying, okay, this is done, I'm going to finalize it, and then finalizing it in as a book or as a final web gallery is... scary stuff because you have to say, okay, where do I stand on this? Like, what stays in and what leaves? How do I direct this? And doing books is the ultimate scariness because you're investing money into it and you're locking it in. With a web gallery, if you a year later you go, man, that picture really sucks, I'm going to change it. You can. With a book, it's over and done with. It's printed and it's out there. People are consuming it, and that's what's going to live. You know, so I love that. How making those final decisions and locking them into a physical form tends to really focus your mind. You have to make hard decisions. And I think that the problem, to go back to the consuming images on the internet, I think the problem with a lot of imagery on the internet now is that the hard decisions haven't been made. They're just thrown up. And I know when I throw up an image that's just like a throwaway, you get like, especially if it's of my dogs, you get like 60 likes, and then I throw up, you know, this picture and four people like it. And I think it's because the Facebook crowd is not really into consuming this. You know, they're more into dogs and cats and fireworks and stuff like that. So that goes back to me thinking you have to find the right delivery mechanism for your work. And it could be an exhibition, it could be wheat pasting laser prints on hoardings, it could be a book, could be a magazine, it could be trying to get it into one of the big blogs, you know, like Lenser or something like that, or it could just be putting in prints in a little book and showing it to your friends, you know. Those are all valid and viable ways of distributing imagery.
Can I ask, what is wheat?
Wheat pasting is well, you know, when they put the posters up on the wood around buildings, they use wheat paste. So the wheat, WHEAT. I think it's a paste.
Flour and water.
Yeah, flour and water. So they sort of go and they brush it on and put the poster up.
So you could put that when you were describing earlier your idea that the windows, you would just wheat paste.
No,
glass.
I would have framed the images and put them on the inside of the glass, on the windows.
That's it.
That's what I would have done. That's but in two
the same
two
concept,
two blocks.
The same
it, well, it's a little different, but what it is it's just putting the pictures out there for people to bump into. And then I decided, well, when they offered me the show at the City Hall Gallery, I thought, well, this is kind of too perfect to pass up because it is the belly of the beast. Are we done? Or is anyone else?
Yeah.
Oh, uh-oh.
What's next?
Oh, retirement. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. That's what Cindy asked me. What are you going to do when this is all done? Because, you know, this is hasn't really been consuming. The one thing I have is I'm 61 now, and I kind of slowing down a little. I think I kind of see the drug thing and this as both about Ottawa in a kind of an oblique way, this more directly. And I think what I want to do is I want to do the thing that scares me the most is I want to go to the suburbs and photograph the suburbs. Well, the reason that it scares me the most is when I'm out working, like say you're a CEO and you're her assistant, you're scared of her. I'm not scared of her. And you're the guy that empties the trash can. You're not scared of her. You're scared of her. You're the middle management. You got the most to lose. She's used to it. She's got a certain amount of power. She trusts me. She's getting the profile. You don't care. She's emptying the trash, right? So, but to me, you're like the suburbs. The middle management, and you have the most to lose, and you're the most petrified of some guy coming up and saying, yo, can I come in and take a picture of you sitting in your living room? Well, I wouldn't do it like that. Obviously, we'd have some kind of conversation. But then you would go, what if my boss sees it? What if it's weird? What if it shows up somewhere I don't want it to? You know, and I mean, I tell people when I photograph, I say, you know, a lot of people are going to see this because a lot of people see my pictures. So I always make that really clear. And you're petrified. So that, to me, is what's really scary about going to the suburbs is the fact that I think that people are going to say, get off my property. And I think that's also why you see many images of blue collar and under people. It's because they don't have anything to lose when someone comes up to them and says, the subtext is, will you allow me to recontextualize you? And they go, yeah, sure. It's like no one even contextualizes us. So why don't we, you know, recontextualize? Fine.
You don't really say that word, do you?
I don't. No, actually, no. I will. I'll tell them, you know, I'm like we're going to, like, say I meet you at a gas station and there's something about your haircut, which actually I noticed when I walked in. Don't take it personally. It's memories of bowl, right? Your haircut?
It's a Cuban haircut.
Yeah, okay. A Cuban haircut?
The Cuban.
Okay, so I looked and I thought, wow, it's like if that grew out a little, he could be like Mo from the Three Stooges, and so this is my thought process. I'm happy, but whether you do or not, this is actually the kind of veracity when I meet a stranger that I use. It's like I'll talk about stuff like this, and what that does is it breaks down all the bullshit, right? And if you're insulted, then we'll work it through, and maybe I don't get to take your picture.
Something's
but at least
start.
I've been honest, right? At least I've been honest. So I will use that. I'll say, you know, we're going to work together, and I'm going to show you a Polaroid. But in the end, the power rests with me. You know, like this is what the work looks like, and you can see what I'm doing. You can see that I'm a serious guy about this. But you have to give me a certain amount of trust, and either you do or you don't. So I mean, to me, I think that honesty is the best way forward. I had an assistant a long time ago, and all my assistants want to do what I do. They want to go out in the street and take pictures. It's just this thing that happens to assistants, especially if they're just out of school. And Christina said, well, I want to do what you do, but I don't know how to do it. And I said, well, you have to tell them the truth. And she said, well, what's the truth? And I said, well, I don't really know, but I think in your case, what I would do is I would, when I saw someone I wanted to photograph, I would go up and say, like, excuse me, like, I'm trying to learn how to take pictures of people on the street. So my boss does, and he takes really cool shots. And there's something about you that I find really interesting. Like, can you spare me 10 minutes so I can try to figure this out? Because that's the honest thing. She's trying to figure it out,
in other
right?
In she doesn't even have a reason to reason. There's something there.
Her reason is research and development, and she's picked you. So first of all, you're flattered. Second of all, I hope this doesn't sound too sexist. She's like a gorgeous 22-year-old blonde, which never hurts, right? I mean, I know that sounds sort of wrong, but it certainly goes a long way to gaining access. But that's in her case, that would be the honest way of doing it. I'm trying to figure something out. There's something about you that interests me. Can you work with me? Will you be kind to me? And the amazing thing is if you're honest,
you're asking for help.
And when people want to help, right? And then you're slightly flattered too, because there's something about you that she finds attractive. So I mean, it sort of feeds in. It is a kind of manipulation, but I also think that the, at least it's an honest manipulation, and so what you have to do if you're interested in doing that kind of work is you have to figure out your own motivations.
I've done it actually where you are in front of the where the people are in missions and all.
Uh-huh.
I've done it. I had no problems doing it, but then I haven't done it for the same reason, because I didn't start the dialogue.
Right.
So the minute you start the dialogue, it's really not a problem.
Exactly. And like I said before, to me, the whole idea of the conversation, the social intercourse, is what I find most fascinating. And I kind of think that with my portraiture, the photos are really just souvenirs of the intercourse. It's just like an excuse, right? But what really interests me, I think more than the photos, is going and meeting these people and talking to them, sitting on their front steps and spending 45 minutes talking to a stranger. It's like they ask you questions, you ask them questions, and it's just all. It's like it's better than TV, because it's like you can feel the wind and you know, trains go by in the distance and stuff like that. It's just really real.
So in the suburbs, they don't set out on their porch tonight.
No, they might, but I don't know if they'd ask you into their house. I'm going to find out.
Backyard.
I'm going to find out. So that's one thing. That's one thing, and then another thing is I maybe want to do something that's just like really raw and expressive and really really fucked up, but I don't know if I have that in me, because I'm too much of a formalist. I don't know. Boris Mikhailov, maybe. Larry Clark, some of the Japanese guy with what's going on in photography in Japan now, I think is really, really interesting. That kind of stuff. But I'm always envious when I see really loose, dynamic, lively pictures. I'm always envious and wish I could do it, but whenever I try to do it, it never works out. And I think that's because, funnily enough, even though the machine is this thing that you think you can make it do anything you want, you can't. There's something about your aesthetic proclivities and your personality and the stress of your years since birth that interact with the machine and then make a certain thing come out a certain way. And I, at least with me, maybe it's because I'm stunted or something and can't, you know, sort of photograph in a broad range of styles. But I kind of think that even though it's a photo mechanical process, I still think you can't subtract the intelligence of the operator. And that has a huge effect on the way your pictures look. I mean, you look at most of the famous photographers. Sorry?
Didn't we all take the same pictures?
We would all take the same pictures, yeah. So I mean, when you look at like the really famous photographers, I think that what you're seeing an authenticity them accepting that the symbiosis of their personality and the tool and what they make with that. They're not trying to mimic or ape. What they're doing is, okay, how can I use this tool to be authentic? And I think it's the authenticity that always makes people sit up and pay attention. That's what I think. It's easy to imitate. So last story is in 2000, I went to show my commercial work to Claire Vandermeer. She's the photo editor of Report on Business magazine. And up to that point, I shot these classical black and white portraits. kind of old-fashioned, beautifully rendered. People sort of go, whoa, that looks pretty cool. And I showed them to her, and she tore me a new one. Decade ago. Claire Vandermeer. And she tore me a new one. And I remember leaving thinking, what the fuck does she know? She's a stupid idiot. And I'm driving home, and I get to Kingston, and I think, what if she's right? And then I pulled into my driveway, and I thought, I've been thinking about it all the time, I thought, she's right. So I spent 2 years, a year and a half, trying to figure out how to make my work more modern. And I was trying, pulling all these stops. A lot of it was really derivative. But I didn't want to settle until I found something that smelled like me. And I can stink sometimes. And funnily enough, it was in the desert outside of Los Angeles that I had my epiphany. I was working there. I was doing all these personal projects trying to figure out how to make my work modern. But I don't want to just, like, imitate Terry... who's the guy? Terry Richardson. Or I don't want to, you know, imitate Todd Hedo. Or I don't want to, you know, all those people. As it has to feel real to me. And then I was outside Los Angeles in the desert, and I was shooting film, but I had a feeling that something was happening. And I came home, and I looked at the film, and I thought, no, okay, Eureka. I've actually done it. And I sent those pictures to Claire, and then she said, oh, and I said, you know, I'm going to use a nasty word here. I said, when you tore me a new one, I was driving home, and I thought you were the biggest cunt in the world. I said to her, and she laughed, and I said, but you know, then I realized you were right, and here's what I've done, because you told me that. And she looked at it and said, well, congratulations, would you like to come to Toronto and shoot a huge feature for us? And I said, yes. And I shot the feature, which should have been the most boring thing in the world, when I plugged my newfound authenticity, modern authenticity, into it, and we shot it, and it won a National Magazine Award. And that was because she had enough balls to tell me my work sucked, and I had enough ovaries to say, you're right.
Sometimes you need that someone to...
Yeah, and sometimes you have you have to consider the... I mean, if someone up the street came up to me, I mean, she knows what she's talking about, right? So she's a person I respect. When I was doing the Stephanie book, I worked with two people that I've never met who were fundamental to how that book looked. I met with a guy named Timothy Archibald in San Francisco, and a guy named Colin Pentel. Timothy's a photographer in San Francisco, and Colin Pentel is a photography writer. He lives in Bath, in England. I had never met them, but I knew they were following the work, and I sent them an email saying, I'm doing this book, but I don't know what I'm doing. Like, can I work with you on this? And they both said, yes, we would like to. And they both provided me with input that didn't really shift the fundamental focus of the book, but a lot of the nuance in it was only because these two complete strangers that I'd never met were giving me honest opinion, and I was seeking it, and I was listening to them.
I asked
the strangers for help, and some of it I accepted, and some of it I rejected. But the book would have looked different if those two complete strangers hadn't, and I've still never met them. We're like online; it's online. If those two strangers hadn't given me input, the book would have been different. I sent them an email. Like, I knew they were following the work, because they had... Colin has a blog, quite a well-read blog, and someone, I think when the New York Times did a thing on User, and I was getting hate mail from around the world, and I think I sort of lost it at a certain point, and I wrote to someone and said, if you don't like these fucking pictures, just, like, look at pictures of flowers and fuck off. And Colin wrote sort of a big thing on his blog about that exchange. I said, oh, this guy's paying attention. And then I knew from there, and then Timothy also had sent me emails, and I had talked to him about some work he was doing with his autistic son. And so we were sort of interchanging ideas and thoughts anyway. And then I thought, okay, these are two righteous dudes, and I think that what they can bring to the table is important to consider. And even asking the questions and rejecting their suggestions doesn't leave you where you were. Asking the questions and rejecting their suggestions puts you somewhere else. So all that is just a form of movement. So this goes back to the Claire Vandermeer's thing, is I seek out people who I trust and who have simpatico, and talk to them about my work. And it all happens, and people typically like doing that, you know, and sometimes we'll Skype, and now that I know how to Skype, we'll Skype, but so I think that that's really important, and to be honest enough with yourself. I mean, you need the ego to go out and do it, first of all, but then if you fall in love with your ego, you lose your perspective. So I think you have to have the ego, but you can't be totally infatuated or in love with it. Because without the ego, you wouldn't move forward. But when you, like I say, when you fall in love, then your perspective is out the door. And without perspective, as an artist, you're worth nothing. It's your perspective that is what makes you an artist. Balancing. Get it tattooed. My perspective makes me an artist. And my face tattoo.
Where do I find that on Photoshop?
Yeah. Yeah, it only comes through practice.
Filter, I think.
Well, people fall back, right? People fall back on the cliche and on the filter that's familiar to them. And I think it's really important to know and understand those, but I think it's also important to maybe try to move beyond them too. Because that's where it's really exciting.
Here's an example, you know, your subjects for portraiture, you're asking for them to help, which is good, because that makes it work. But this idea of asking for journalists or photographers to follow you because you respect their work, or you know they're interested in what you're interested in.
Well, I don't ask them to follow me. In the case of Timothy and Colin, I emailed them and said, will you help me with my book? So I actually I was soliciting their input. I said, this is the project. I don't know what I'm doing. And I need help. And then we started from there. So, I mean, we follow each other just as a matter of course. I follow, you know, I've got like 1,300 Facebook friends. I don't know who they are. But there's 8 or 10 people who I would feel comfortable saying, will you help me with this?
This process, when you did that, were you saying, you know, because it's like a lifeline, but you're throwing out the lifeline, you're saying, I gotta get this thing going, it's important to you, but you didn't know what the next step was.
Well, I knew what the next step was, but it was such a complicated story that I'd lost a lot of perspective, partly because of what it was about, you know, this like heroin addict was living at my house, and so I think that was a large part of it. And I was too close, and I needed someone who was a little more removed to come in and kick my ass a little. So, but I think, you know, if you can find someone who you trust who will do that, and if you're brave enough to ask them, and then brave enough to consider what they've said, I think that it can go a long way. But like the Claire Vandermeer thing was the classic case in point, where she said, you know, this stuff's crap. I mean, I know what you're doing, and it's beautiful, but it's crap. And then me going, yeah, okay, but 5 hours later, as I'm playing with driving, no, she's right. She's right, it's crap.
I'll use an example. I hate criticism, like, as an individual, but when it comes to photography, I want it.
Uh-huh.
I need it.
Well, the criticism's easy. What's difficult is taking steps about what the criticism's about. That's the most difficult thing. And like when Claire talked about it, it took me a year and a half of failure and frustration and struggle and capital expenditure to try to work through it and past where I had been comfortable resting. And unless you're willing to do that, then I think I talk about authenticity. That's where the authenticity comes. You have to have the desire to become uncomfortable, I think the comfort is the number one enemy you got to be comfortable to create. But I think if the comfort leads to complacency, then you just become boring. Right? Anyone want to arm wrestle?
Oh, how's Stephanie doing?
She's got out of jail. She was in for 100 days for driving without a license and shoplifting. She's the world's worst thief. I say to her staff, she was 156 pounds. That's a good sign. She's 5'2". The heavier she is, the happier we are. When she got out of hospital, the day she got out of hospital, she had like the big scar in the back of her head where they did the surgery. And we went to Shoppers Drug Mart to get a shower cap. And while she was there, she stole a bunch of scrunchies. You know what a scrunchie is? It's a thing. So, and she's still in her hospital, like, sort of pajama-y things. And she takes the scrunchies and she puts them down the front of her pants to steal them. And then she goes off to find a store clerk to help her find a shower cap. Because I don't know if you know about drug addicts, but they're very pushy. It's like when you drive down Cumberland Street and the crack addict walks in front of your car and you have to stop. And they don't go fast. That's because they're exercising with the only power they have, which is to fuck you up. In a non really horrible way. I mean, they can hit you on the head and take your money, but so she goes off. She finds this woman. Says, "Where's your shower caps? I need, you know, I got a thing." And so the woman says, "Follow me." And as Stephanie's following her, the scrunchies are falling through her path. There's this trail of almost stolen scrunchies. Behind Stephanie, I go, "Stephanie, it's like, stop stealing stuff because like you're like the worst thief in the world." So anyway, she stole, she got caught, and she went to jail for 100 days, and now she's out.
Oh, she's still in America.
Yeah.
Your lack of humanity is horrifying.
What does that mean?
I don't know. He goes off on stuff.
Yeah.
I have to think about that.
I'm not going to think about it at all.
Okay. Shall we?
We done?
Close. Welcome to talk.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yep.